Welcome to The Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal bringing you fiction, nonfiction, and other readings with a local connection. This program is intended for a print impaired audience. It is brought to you by Audio Journal. Material is selected with the interest of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. I'm Joanne, and today I will be reading from The Summer Club by Hannah McKinnon. And this is episode 2. Now, you remember, Nate is in charge of the country club, and he is now going to read some of the suggestions from his little box. Why are people wearing jeans in the dining room? Don't they know we have a dress code? And not for nothing, it's always the young members. The club's pilgrim logo feels dated. We're in Massachusetts, but why a pilgrim? And why a man? Where is our female representation? Has anyone noticed the growing stack of Cartier Love bracelets on Coral Delancey's arm? Rumor has it, cheating. Dick may have taken more than his new Porsche for a spin after the Memorial Day dinner dance. Good for Coral for commanding. Fling bling. But at the right, this rate, the poor girl won't be able to lift her arms. Well, well, Ned made it a practice to ignore club rumors, but this one wouldn't go away, and he had noticed Dick sneaking cocktails to the leggy lead singer after Curl left early. Not club business, he decided, slipping it into his pocket. Not something he should keep from Ingrid that night at dinner, either. He moved on to the next. Why are our tennis courts being used by the local boarding school? Whose grand idea was this? Ned sat back in his chair and rubbed his head, the same head he had come up with the grand idea. One thing he learned since becoming president, Mayhaven had a cash flow problem quickly careening into the red. Ned suspected the board had not exactly been transparent with him for fear he might not take the job. In the same vein, he didn't share that problem with membership, for fear it might send them scurrying to the new club, Fox Run. There was no quick fix for a cash flow problem, but there were ways to plug the holes. A paying partnership with the local boarding school was one. Another was their decision to open the summer camp to the public, something that had never been considered before. Just how public? Dick Delancey had asked when Ned proposed this to the board. He said the word public like it was an STD. Residents of Rockwood, where many of us are from, I believe, he reminded Dick. Dick wrinkled his nose. Still. Naaman Shrive had shrugged. This side of the gates has always been for those who are paying members. I'm all for letting folks over, but they should pay. That's the point, Ned explained. We are getting paid for camp and court use. It will help our revenue. He held up the most recent spreadsheet of operating costs. If we want to continue all of our planned projects, this is the only way. The vote had been unanimous. There was a knock on his door. Mr. Birch! It was Alta Bennington, a member so new Ned had just cashed her check that week. Alta was not only new, but young, probably one of the jean-wearing offenders in the restaurant. Her adorable daughter, Paisley, peeked around her. Another woman stood behind her. Ned stood and smiled at all three. Please, come in. Alta sent Paisley to sit on the hallway bench with the other woman and marched in. Ned could not help but notice her tanned bare midriff as she sat down across from him. Another reason he should send that dress code email. She did not look happy. How are you settling in that Mayhaven? He ventured. That's why I'm here. Alta cocked her head as if waiting for him to read her mind. You don't offer daycare. Ned was sure he'd said as much when he'd given the Benningtons a tour. We have a summer camp for children age 5 and up. And, of course, our littlest members are welcome at the beach in the restaurant with their parents anytime. But I'm afraid you're right. We do not offer child care services per se. And he was pretty sure it would stay that way. Toddlers on the tennis court just did not make sense. Alta didn't blink. Someone needs to watch my Paisley. I can't very well play tennis with a 2-year-old. No, I don't imagine you can, Ned said, trying to sound empathetic. So you need child care. Ned would not tell Alta that it appeared she needed child care. Instead, he said, have you asked any of the other members about babysitting recommendations? Many of them have teenagers who babysit. My own daughter, in fact. Alta nodded toward the woman in the hallway with Paisley. I have a nanny. I don't need a babysitter. Ah, then you have child care. This was becoming confusing. My nanny needs a break. Oh, I see. Actually, Ned did not see what any of this had to do with him or the club. But Alta was a member he personally signed, and he felt he needed to try and offer her something. So back to a babysitter. Would you like me to make some inquiries? We can't leave Paisley with just anyone, which is why I think Mayhaven should offer services for its members. She paused. A certified professional with an education degree, of course. Of course. On it went until Paisley noisily joined them with a wet diaper minus the nanny. See what I mean? Alta cried, whisking her daughter up and away. Always nice to see you, Ned called after them. A moment later, there was another knock on his door. Ned looked up, afraid to see Alta Bennington's bare midriff again. Thankfully, it was his head chef, Mosimo, but he also did not look happy. Sorry to interrupt, Mr. Birch, but there's a problem with the cutlery, he said, coming to stand over Ned's desk. Mosimo never sat. Ned looked up at him. What's wrong with the cutlery? Silverware has gone missing. It started with a fork here and a knife there. So at first, I didn't think much of it. But when I took inventory yesterday, I noticed that we appeared to be missing complete sets of our silver. The good silver? Back in the club founding days, there had been a gift by one of the earliest and wealthiest members, Regina Blackstone, in the form of cutlery for the newly constructed dining room. According to club history, the silver had only been used twice yearly during those early years, once for the opening season dinner party and once for the closing. As the club grew and modernized, the restaurant turned more economical and practical flatware. Since then, the good cutlery was only brought out for special club occasions or for the odd member wedding when it was specially requested by those in the know. Yes, sir, Mosimo confirmed. The Blackstone silver. Ned sat back in his chair. The Blackstone silver was part of the club's heritage and legacy. It had been used a few times in the last year, but to have exact sets missing was definitely odd. Do you have any suspicions? Mosimo reared back slightly. No one on my staff, I assure you. The chef was sleepily sensitive about his kitchen, employees and all. Ned appreciated that. Well, we'll have to keep our eyes open, I guess. When are we planning to use it next? The first scramble of the season. All right, let's count it once more before the scramble dinner and again after. Alert the staff to keep watching during service. Ned hated to ask staff to spy on members. That was the direct opposition to the spirit he had hoped to cultivate at Mayhaven. But what choice did he have? Ned glanced at the clock. He was 5 minutes late for the grounds meeting. As he was gathering his folders, his phone rang. It was Ingrid. He really did not have time, but he took the call. He's shooting, Ned! Shooting! Ned almost dropped his folders. What? Who? Are you okay? I'm sorry, honey. We're fine. I meant the neighbor. Stan is in the backyard shooting some kind of giant bow and arrow. I just saw him through the living room window. What is he shooting? You're not going to like this. It appears to be our old scarecrow. They had just cleaned out the garage over the weekend, and the old scarecrow was part of a large pile of tired yard decorations Ingrid had deemed garbage. Just that morning, Ned had carried it down to the curb for trash pickup, alongside a broken Halloween sign and some dead Christmas tree lights. Ned was sentimental to a fault, and he knew he could be a pack rat. But he felt especially bad about the scarecrow, even though it was missing an arm. He and Adam had made it a few years ago in Scouts. It still wore Ned's old Red Sox t-shirt, a favorite that he spilled spaghetti sauce on, and Ingrid had also made him give up. "Stan went through our trash?" Ned asked. If Ingrid wouldn't let him have the scarecrow, the neighbors couldn't either. "Well, I wouldn't go that far. It was left on the curb, after all. But did you hear what I said about the crossbow? He's shooting that thing alongside our backyard. I'm afraid to let Fritzy out. Is that even legal?" "It's definitely not safe," Ingrid sighed. "Wait until you hear the sound it makes when it hits your scarecrow." "He's actually hitting the scarecrow?" This made it even worse. "Right through the heart of your Red Sox shirt," Ingrid brightened. "At least his aim is good." Ned did not like the sound of any of this, not about the bow or his scarecrow or his favorite old t-shirt. He put a hand to his own chest and glared at the clock. "Honey, I have to go." If opening day wasn't stressful enough, now going home would be too. Agitated and now very late, Ned took the stairs two at a time, wondering if he'd be murdered beside his pool later, and who in their right mind shot at the Red Sox. New chapter called Darcy. Ellie Watson was only 6 years old, but she was already primed to be one mean middle schooler. "Time for your tennis lesson," Darcy said in her most encouraging voice. Ellie glared up at her from where she slumped by the court fence. "Can't make it. Can't make me." Darcy opened her mouth, but nothing came out. It hadn't occurred to her that this was something a six-year-old would think she had the option to turn down. "But Ellie, you're signed up for tennis, and it's your turn." Ellie positioned herself away from her counselor and fixed her gaze on a dandelion, which she grabbed and snapped the head off. "Are you deaf?" Lily, who was helping another camper tie her shoes, sputtered laughter. All of their campers were already on the courts with Molly, the tennis instructor, except Ellie, who was refusing, and her little friend Savannah, who looked like she might cry if Ellie didn't go with her. "Ellie," Darcy tried again, determined to ignore the insult. "Your mother dropped you off with this beautiful new racket this morning." Darcy lifted the racket from the grass and held it up. "Look, it even got your name engraved on it." The amount of money and time spent on superfluous details by these parents was completely wasted on their kids, Darcy thought. How many crustless sandwiches or tiny containers of hand-rolled sushi had she tossed in the trash in favor of another camper's crumpled bag of Doritos? The personalized brand-name sportswear thrown on the ground, dropped on the trail, left sopping wet in the sand. These kids had so much and seemed to appreciate so little. Ellie turned to Darcy. "You can have it. I hate the racket, and I hate tennis." Darcy was at least happy she hadn't added, "And I hate you," though from the ire in her stare, it was likely. Time for some reverse psychology. Darcy examined the racket adoringly. "Thanks, I think I will." Then, before Ellie could object, she hopped up onto her feet and headed for the court. "You coming, Lily? Savannah?" Savannah looked unsure, but followed Lily, who followed Darcy. "Let's play together." Darcy wasn't any good at tennis. Golf had been her thing. But it didn't matter, as long as she got Savannah out there and showed Ellie what a good time she was missing. "I suck at tennis," Lily mouthed to her. "Just do I," Darcy mouthed back. They practiced their serves as Molly instructed the group. Tennis balls went everywhere, and campers scrambled after them, but everyone was laughing. At one point, Darcy caught Ellie watching. After 15 minutes, Darcy was sweating. "This is harder than it looks," Lily said as she dashed after a stray ball. "So is she," Darcy nodded toward Ellie, still planted in the same spot in the grass. When the lesson ended, Darcy marched over to where she sat. "Thanks for letting me borrow your racket. It's really good." Ellie shrugged. "Too bad you aren't." Darcy forced herself a smile. One thing she knew from being Adam's sister was that his mood often depended on worries or anxieties he had. She had given a try to figure out what it was with Ellie. The day was hot, so she directed the campers to a shaded picnic table by the trees for lunchtime. "Cool golf carts," one of the little boys said, pointing. "When can we drive those?" another asked. Darcy followed their gaze to the row of parked carts. "We're focusing on tennis this session," she told them. "The carts are for the kids who take golf lessons." She'd chosen this group of campers only because it let her avoid the course and the game and her old instructor. At that moment, Vince pulled up. He high-fived Camper just as he used to with her. Darcy felt a pang watching them. "Is it weird seeing him up there?" "What?" Darcy spun around to find Lily standing beside her. "Your old golf coach. Since you quit, it must be weird being back and bumping into him." Lily was looking at her sympathetically. "I know your parents are still upset about it."
"Oh, no, I don't even think about it," Darcy lied. She took a seat on the bench and rifled through her lunch bag, even though she pretty much lost her appetite. Lily had never questioned Darcy about quitting. To her, it was a bonus. Now her best friend had the whole summer free to hang out together, which was fine with Darcy. Her parents bugged her about it enough, but still, it was different being able to be open to a friend. She stared at the chicken sandwich her mother had made and forced herself to take a bite, but only a small one. The scale that morning had shown that she'd lost another pound, and Darcy wanted to keep it going. It felt good to finally have something moving in the right direction it was supposed to. She figured if she looked good, she'd feel good, something she hadn't in longer than Darcy could remember, and especially since she was working summer camp at a club beach with the likes of Spencer Delancey. Never mind the bronzed blonde who'd shown up at the camp that morning as the newest senior counselor. "Ashley Riley," Lily had whispered as they both watched her roll in. "Even her name is a pick me." Ashley had not been at orientation last week with the rest of them, but the girl was a country club poster child. Not that Darcy was allowed to call May Haven a country club. "It's an association," her father always corrected her. "Call it a club even, but please not country club." Darcy had snorted. "Like there's a difference?" Her father looked hurt. "Country club has a negative connotation for a lot of people. They're exclusive. They don't have the best histories when it comes to inclusion or diversity. May Haven is so much more." Whatever that meant, she'd have to ask her dad how Ashley landed a camp job at their association without doing the required time like she had. Rumor was she'd been vacationing in Santorini with her family, who were May Haven legacy members, just like Spencer's family. "She seems tight with everyone here," Lily observed, sounding equal parts annoyed and intrigued by Ashley Riley. "But I don't recognize her from school." "Because she goes to boarding school," Molly, the tennis instructor, had chimed in from behind them. Darcy had blushed deeply. She hadn't realized how loud they were. "Surely you met Ashley up here before?" Darcy shook her head. "Don't remember if I did." Then she added, "I don't come up here as much as I used to." She was relieved when Molly didn't ask her why. Now, Darcy and Lily stared as Ashley sauntered up to Spencer's table. He actually looked up from his lunch and flashed his killer smile. "Hey, Ash." "He calls her Ash," Lily hissed. "I have ears," Darcy hissed back. "Forget her. We need to focus on our kids." It seemed that campers needed help with everything, putting straws in juice boxes, opening thermoses, cleaning up spills. That was just lunchtime. By the time they headed to the locker rooms to change into swimsuits, there was an endless chorus of campers calling her name. "Help me with the sunscreen. Where's my towel? Who took my goggles?" Darcy didn't mind. She was getting to know them and finding favorites, even though she knew she shouldn't. For little kids, they had big personalities. One camper, a wiry ginger-haired boy named Evan, was apparently a budding ornithologist. He'd spent the morning identifying birds and telling Darcy all about them. Then there was Savannah, who was tall and shy and hovered near Darcy with saucer-shaped eyes. Darcy would have to help her make friends, she could tell. And then there was Ellie, who seemed to hate everything camp had to offer, and maybe Darcy too. "Are you excited to swim?" Darcy asked her as she headed down the shady trail to the lake. After lunch, Ellie shrugged. Stupid question. Ellie wasn't excited about anything. "I am. I can do the crawl," Evan piped up. Then, "Hear that? That's a woodpecker. Wonder if it's the pileated kind." He squinted up into the branches. Darcy laughed. "How about you?" she asked Savannah, who was glued to her side. Savannah lifted one shoulder uncertainly. "I'm not very good." "How about we swim together?" Darcy suggested. She knew the others would join. They were like little lemmings. She'd help Savannah make small talk with them when they did. Down on the beach, she was dismayed not to see Spencer up in the guard chair. Kate, the other lifeguard, sat in his place. Damn, she'd even worn her cute daisy bikini top. At least the day was hot and the water felt nice. Ellie refused to go in, but Savannah did eventually. Darcy became so busy playing Marco Polo with the kids, took turns with Kate for swim tests, that the season flew by. The session flew by. Suddenly, it was time to bring the campers back up the clubhouse for pickup. Darcy was exhausted but happy. She made it through the first day of camp. She closed her eyes and leaned against the wall as she waited outside the locker room for her campers to change. Suddenly, the front door at the end of the hall banged to close. Darcy stood at attention, expecting to see a parent. Instead, it was a boy about her age. He wasn't dressed like a member. He looked kind of cute, if lost. He glanced up at the sparkling chandelier and flipped his dark hair out of his big brown eyes. Yep, very cute. It wasn't dress code, but she liked his Tyler, the Creator shirt in red Converse. When he saw her standing there, he hesitated, then handed away. Darcy straightened. "Hey." The boy cleared his throat, looking nervous. "Hi, I'm looking for the main office." "For Dad's office? You have a delivery?" He held up his empty hands. "Seriously? You look lost, and I didn't recognize you, so I just thought..." The kid shook his head. "Yeah, I got it. I got you." "What?" Darcy grimaced. "I'm sorry. It's just that people who come looking for the office are usually here for delivery." "God," she sounded pathetic. "I didn't mean..." "Mean what?" Darcy felt like his big brown eyes could see right through her, thoughts and all. He had her there. What had she meant? That he was wearing street clothes instead of a collared shirt and boat shoes? That he was not a member? That his skin was darker than hers? God, she had not meant that. "No, I don't know. Look, I'm sorry." "Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God." And then he smiled at her, a big, fat, playful smile that rescued them both. "Nah, I'm just messing with you. It's cool." Darcy exhaled. She still felt like an a-hole, and she knew she deserved to. But she was grateful. "The office is right over there," she said, finding her voice again. She pointed to her father's door. "Who are you looking for?" "Mr. Birch. I have an interview." Darcy nodded at her father's name, but gave away nothing. "Well, good luck, then. I'm Darcy, by the way." She extended her hand. "Flick." Flick took her hand, and she glanced down at their clasped fingers. "Thanks, Darcy." Darcy watched him walk down the hall and through her father's office door. Flick. Who named that kid that? She wondered if she'd see him again. She suddenly hoped she would. It has a new chapter called Flick. Mayhaven was everything his mother had hoped it would have be and everything he feared. The clubhouse was one of those nondescript clapboard buildings that might be a church, a prep school, or a country club, all of which housed pasty people in preppy clothes. So really, what was the difference? The moment he walked through the front doors, Flick looked down and realized his first mistake, his concert t-shirt and sneakers. Then he looked up and he realized his second, a place with a chandelier that sparkly probably demanded an equally glittery resume, which he did not have. Honestly, Flick didn't want this job to begin with, and he noted it before he even stepped foot inside Mayhaven. The IRB idea of a summer job wasn't the problem. Flick was bored stiff in their dead, dull town, and having something to do and money of his own seemed like a good idea, despite what Stan had said to him when they moved in. Flick didn't feel comfortable asking him for pocket money, or anything else for that matter. the house, the pool, the sports cars. It was all as foreign to him as the empty green expanse of their new rural life and the eternal thrum outside his window each night, from which his mother informed him were peepers, whatever they were. Flick missed the sound of street noise, the bustle of the city sidewalks, the throngs of people. Rockwood was too quiet, the new house so isolated, and he knew nobody. School would be the only way to meet people his age, but that wouldn't start for another 2 months. So a job would be a way to kill time until then. Which is why Flick had suggested he'd go to the local grocery market and ask if they were hiring. He'd been a cashier before back in Queens, and it wasn't rocket science. But Josie said no, that they didn't need the money, so any job he should get would be more than that. They were in new place making a fresh start. Josie wanted him to network, to rub elbows, as she put it. Why? Flick wanted to know. You need to meet people, so they might as well be people with connections. Kids around here come from good families and go to good colleges. Who you know can help. Flick was mildly offended. First, just because folks had money didn't make them good. She, of all people, having cleaned up after them in her housekeeping work, should know that. Second, as for good families, hadn't they already been a good family back in New York? Adding Stan to dry cleaning king in a forest of trees full of stinging bugs didn't count for any improvement as far as Flick was concerned. Third, he'd always done well in school, and Josie hadn't put much emphasis on that before, beyond the fact that he went. Now that they were living in Rockwood, Josie was online every night perusing Rockwood attractions and associations, the local playhouse and the yoga classes down at the lake. Stan had his own take on it. To him, moving to the country meant he had to tame it or hunt it, a novel way to assert his malehood. To his mother's horror, Stan had gone out to buy eggs the other morning and came home from the sporting goods store with a giant crossbow. Are you crazy? You're going to kill someone with that, she warned him. That's the plan. Ever had venison? Josie made a face. That's what grocery stores are for. Besides, you're not killing some poor innocent animal, Stan. Oh, come on. The deer are a dime a dozen up here. That's why they have hunting season. Josie stood her ground. You want to shoot something? Make a target in the backyard, facing away from the house. I did not move up here for you to murder Bambi. But Josie was just as guilty with her own fantasies. We can learn to sail, she said one night at dinner, which sounded like a joke coming from a woman who got seasick on the Staten Island ferry. It was like she'd woken up in some kind of fairy tale, and she was hungry to not only get the lay of the land, but to insert herself into it, which is how she found out about Mayhaven. Look at this. Josie was stationed at the marble waterfall counter with her laptop, another new purchased a few nights earlier. They were having another opulent meal of oversized steaks grilled on the oversized Weber in the outdoor kitchen, which was as big as the indoor one. There's a country club just up the road, her mother shrieked. I had no idea. Stan flashed his toothy grin from his station at the grill, as though he had something to do with that fact. Only the best neighborhood for my girl. It's called Mayhaven, Josie says. Sounds like Mayflower, doesn't it? Flick leaned over her shoulder to see what his mother was so excited about. Oh, my God, Josie squealed. Their logo is a pilgrim. I was right. The club homepage showed a white clapboard building with a towering flagpole. The whole thing looked like a mini White House with a pilgrim on a sign. Josie read the heading aloud. Welcome to Mayhaven, where summer is eternal. Flick rolled his eyes. Sounds stupid. Stan joined them. Sounds pricey. Stan did that. He commented on how expensive everything was. In the same breath, he insisted only the best. But a dreamy look was already spreading across Josie's face. It's just a mile from our house. Stan, this place looks nice. You always said you wanted to golf. Stan grunted. When did I say that? We should check it out, Josie went on. Who knows? Maybe I'll take up tennis. At that, Stan showed his teeth. You slip into one of those tennis skirts and I'll join today. He wrapped his big hands around her small waist and pressed her lips to hers. Flick had to avert his eyes. Wait, Josie said suddenly. Flick, you should go too. No way, he shook his head. I don't play golf or tennis. Don't plan to. He made the face he reserved for no way in hell, something he rarely did. Josie had asked a lot of him this summer, marrying Stan and abandoning Queens. He'd been flexible and smiled until his face hurt through all of it. But Flick had his limits. Not for the club, said, scrolling down. For a job. Look, there's a notice for summer jobs. Flick was still not interested. What would I do at a country club? Anything they ask you to, Stan chuckled. Those people got money to bring. Keep them happy and they'll tip big. This was another thing Stan did. Spoke with authority on pretty much everything. Flick wanted to ask Stan what kind of country club experience he had. Based on Stan's wardrobe of polyester suits and gold jewelry, Flick would bet his life on zero, but he bit his tongue. Josie kept scrolling. Read this. Under employment opportunities, it says kitchen help wanted. That's what they are calling it now, an opportunity? Stan snorted. Translation, dishwasher. Josie ignored this and instead looked at Flick. Maybe they need restaurant help. You could do that. You love to cook. Flick did like to cook. Before Stan in the country house, any homemade dinner that made its way onto their table in Queens was by him. But he seriously doubted the club wanted a teenage cook self-taught by watching Food Network reruns. Nah, Stan said. A place like that, it's got professional chefs. They'll have him peeling potatoes, washing dishes, cleaning up, grunt work. Josie swiveled on a bar stool and leveled a look at Stan. So, for a guy who knew everything, Stan often forgot that her line of work used to be grunt work. Stan swallowed hard. Flick liked that. As mushy as his mother could be about her new husband, she still spoke her mind. He liked it even more that Stan had the sense to back down when she did. Nothing wrong with honest work, Josie added, eyes locked on her husband's. No, Stan agreed, excusing himself to check on the stakes. Nothing at all. Flick indulged his mother and called the club about the kitchen help opportunity. When he did, man on the phone suggested he come that afternoon. They must have been desperate. Josie was thrilled. See, you've got to hustle, Flick. You can check the place out while you're there. Flick didn't get it. They weren't country club people. He would have been just as happy working at the grocery store or the ice cream shop in town, which, according to his mother, employed some cute girls he thought he should introduce himself to. He couldn't understand why Josie was so obsessed with adopting a new lifestyle just because of a new address. He and his mother were both born and raised in Queens. If, as she insisted, there was nothing wrong with their old lives, their old apartment, and her old job, why was she champing at the bit to dive into a world so different? It didn't matter, he decided, as he stood beneath the giant chandelier in the country club foyer that afternoon. He was there, in the wrong clothes and without a resume. He may as well get the interview over with. The man on the phone, a Mr. Birch, had told him to report directly to the office, but all Flick could see was a trophy case that stretched the length of the hall. The glass case was full of framed photos and engraved awards, every face white, every trophy gold. There were plenty of old men, a couple of old ladies, and a whole lot of college shirts. Flick groaned. That's when he looked up and saw the girl. She wore a polo shirt, khaki shorts that reminded him of a school uniform, and was standing beneath an engraved sign labeled Locker Rooms. These people sure like to engrave things. As he walked toward her, Flick recognized the Mayhaven Pilgrim logo on her shirt. Man, she was in full regalia. But despite that, something about her expression told him she didn't buy into it. Flick was instantly intrigued. In addition to her unamused expression, she was very pretty. Flick couldn't stop staring at the freckles on her nose. And then she asked him if he was a delivery boy, and it all went sideways. At first, Flick thought she was kidding. When he realized she was not, he could feel his hackles go up. Had she said that because of his skin color? Regardless, did she not realize how insensitive she sounded? He forgot all about the freckles. Seriously, he challenged. He realized then that maybe he'd been the one to read it wrong. She was instantly embarrassed, generally so, by the deep flush of her cheeks in the vaporization of all the confidence he admired walking up to her. As she sputtered and blushed in front of him, it was his turn to feel bad. Finally, he held up his hands. "Nah, I'm just messing with you. It's cool." And it was, sort of. She shouldn't have made those assumptions. But the thing was, she seemed like she realized it, and that was enough. What Flick really liked was that Darcy had the guts to introduce herself afterward. As he headed down the hall to find Mr. Birch, Flick fought the urge to look over his shoulder. He was in for another surprise as he walked into the office. No doubt the rich mahogany-paneled walls and golden-framed artwork would have been enough to put him on edge, like a fish out of water, just as the pretty girl in the hallway had. But worse was the familiar face seated in front of him. The man hopped up from his desk chair, mouth ajar. "I'll be darned. I believe we've met." Perspiration was already beading on Flick's upper lip. Oh, yes, they met, just before Stan had slammed the door in their new neighbor's face. "Yes, sir," Flick stammered. Why was he saying sir? He was fully prepared to be thrown out, or, since they were in the country club, be escorted out after the way Stan had treated Ned the other night. But instead, his neighbor extended his hand. "Nice to see you again, Flick." Flick felt his cheeks feel flooded with color as he shook Ned's hand. "Nice to see you too, sir." Again with the sir. Flick didn't even want the job, but he could already feel it being pulled off the table. "But, Mr. Birch, Ned." "No, not here at the club, and certainly not after what Stan had done," smiled broadly. It looked like a real smile, too, not the kind grown-ups flash you when behind their eyes they're secretly sizing you up. "I guess I didn't put it together when we talked on the phone, but this is a nice surprise, real nice. Please have a seat." He indicated one of the two identical upholstered leather chairs opposite his desk. "Take that one. It's more comfy." Flick sat. Was this guy for real? Mr. Birch folded his hands. "How do you like Rockwood?" "Oh, it's fine, I guess. I don't really know it yet." "Yes, it's tough being new, but I bet by summer's end you'll feel more at home." Flick nodded, unsure what to say. "You like rap music?" It took him a second, and then Flick understood. Stan's loud music from the other night, of course, and he was probably going to be blamed for it, because who would believe a 51-year-old retiree listens to Drake? "That's my stepfather," he paused. "Sorry, my mom always tells him to turn it down. She was out that night." Mr. Burke shook his head. No need to apologize, but Flick could tell there was a need for the loud music and also the door being slammed. And probably a host of other things Flick didn't even know about. The interview was a mistake. He could not work for a guy he lived next door to. Before Flick could think up a way to apologize for the things Stan had done, Mr. Burt was off and running into a new direction. "So, I'm guessing you saw our job listing on the website. Which position are you interested in?" Just like that, Flick had to shift gears, only it wasn't so much an interview as a conversation. Mr. Birch wanted to know what kitchen experience he had and didn't seem one bit little concerned about the fact it wasn't formal. Could Flick be flexible and come in early some days or stay late on others? Was Flick open to prepping food before dinner service as well as bussing tables when the restaurant are busy? Flick found himself saying yes, that he was. Before Flick knew it, he was following the guy out of the office and down the hall. Darcy was long gone. Up the carpeted steps they went, Mr. Birch talking the whole time about the club history and its founder, some guy named Wilson. Flick wondered what any of this had to do with the kitchen job, but he nodded politely. At the top of the stairs, they stopped. The second floor was one giant open space, which could either be called a large formal dining room or a small ballroom with a bar at one end. A bank of windows ran along the wall overlooking the golf course. Outside was a wraparound deck with what Flick imagined was an even better view. Flick blinked in the sunlight. "This is the restaurant," Mr. Birch told him. "The kitchen is in the rear, through those swinging doors. You'll be spending most of your time working there. Shall we take a look?" Flick nodded and followed. His Converse sneakers squeaked on the polished hardwoods, and Ned looked over his shoulder. "Sorry," Flick said reflexively. "I didn't unpack my dress shoes yet." "No, no," Ned insisted cheerfully. "You came dressed for the kitchen. I like it." He pushed through the swinging doors and waved hello at the cooks. The kitchen gleamed, and despite the people and the prep work underway, Flick eyed a stainless steel counter loaded with potatoes. Maybe Stan had been right for once. Alongside the mountain of peeled potatoes were boards of chops, celery, and onions. Ooh, did I see clam chowder on the menu? Ned called out. A burly man in checkered shep pants nodded toward a deep sink. In the basin, Flick could see a pile of shellfish. My favorite, Ned declared. Call me if you need a taste tester. The chef did not smile, but he nodded, his eyes on Flick. Wasimo, this is Flick Creevy. He's interviewing for the kitchen prep job. Wasimo crossed his tattooed arms and scowled. You know how to shuck clams? Flick was not prepared for this. He didn't even eat clams. I can learn. Good answer, Ned said. He turned to Wasimo. Flick tells me he has basic chopping and dicing skills. I'll be the judge, Wasimo said curtly. He turned to Flick. I'll give you 15 minutes. I am too busy to give you more. Flick hadn't asked the chef to give him anything. He certainly didn't feel like standing in dour-faced Mosimo's kitchen. It was a sauna. Pots steamed on ranges. Bread was being whisked from ovens, and two people were chopping vegetables at prep stations. The place was a zoo compared to the quiet serenity of the dining room just outside. Got 15 minutes, Ned asked. Sure, Flick said, not feeling sure at all. Wasimo nodded. Very well. Leave him to me, Mr. Ned. I'll send him back down when I'm done. Sounds good, Ned said, eyeing the pot on the stove. Maybe send along a little of the chowder if it's ready. The kitchen door swung shut behind him with a swoosh. Mr. Flick, you come here. Nervous, he followed the chef. Past another prep worker, about his age, and a young woman who was rolling out some kind of dough to a small counter at the rear. Wasimo looked like he had plans for him, and Flick didn't like knowing what they were. 16 minutes later, Flick knocked on Mr. Birch's door and poked his head in. How'd it go, Ned? Asked eagerly. Under the scrutinizing stare of Wasimo, Flick had peeled and chopped one carrot, diced an onion that made his eyes run, and minced and sautéed garlic in a tiny buttered pan that he quickly realized got too hot too fast. Sorry, he had said, holding up the smoking. I never cooked on gas before. Wasimo chuffed like a horse and turned away. For his final test, Flick tried and failed to shuck a clam, and before he cut off his thumb, he had been swiftly relieved of the shucking knife. He had been corrected and redirected and laughed at. He had no idea how it went, other than not great, not great at all. Before he could say as much to Mr. Birch, the phone rang on his desk. Excuse me, just a moment. Ned answered and listened without a word. Then finally, thank you, he hung up the phone. Flick waited as he crossed his arms and leaned back in his armchair. Wasimo said you did well, he said. Flick felt his insides relax. The chef had given him zero indication of that. How did he do? Excuse me, Flick was confused. Wasimo, do you feel like the two of you could work well together? As Flick struggled to reply, Mr. Birch plowed cheerfully on. Don't get me wrong. He's a talented chef, and we're lucky to have him. Oh, you should try his Tuscan bread. Baked artichoke. He smiled to himself before growing serious. But Wasimo is not easy, and the work won't be either. Flick didn't know what to say. It had never occurred to him that anyone in Mr. Birch's position would even consider asking someone in his position how he felt. He was a kid, applying for a kitchen job and a fancy club. Mr. Birch had all the power, not him. One thing you should know, Ned continued, is that we pride ourselves here at Mayhaven on our service. Our members are good people, and this is our special place. We want our staff to understand that. Yes, of course, Flick found himself saying. Here it was, the division of power he'd been expecting. They were at the top, he was at the bottom, like Stan said, to do what they asked. It's no secret that when people feel happy in this place, they will return to it. Sure, Flick said, sitting back in his seat. In other words, what Stan had said. So, I think the real secret is to hire good staff and take good care of them, Mr. Birch concluded. The staff? This was not all what Flick thought was coming next. The staff? Because if our staff are happy, they'll provide good service, and then our members will be happy. See how that works? He raised his index finger and twirled it gently in a circle. What goes around? Flick was dumbfounded by how much we and our Mr. Birch use, as if they were some kind of team, albeit a pastel-clad team. But still, in a place like this, Flick was expecting more us than them. And then, just as quickly as the interview had begun, almost an hour earlier, it ended. Mr. Birch folded his hands neatly on his desk and returned to the question at hand. Massimo likes to say he runs a tight ship. I think of it as a tight family. In that vein, you think you'll be happy here? No way, Mr. Birch was asking Click about his happiness. Despite his nerves, and despite the fact he never wanted this job in the first place, he considered the question. He didn't know Massimo one lick, but the chef had been fair, if firm. I think so, he stammered. Good. I'll give us both the night to think it over, and I'll call tomorrow. On his way out, Flick glanced around at the gleaming trophy case, at the empty hallway where Darcy had stood, and finally up at the chandelier. He shook his head. As he left the air-conditioned comfort of the clubhouse and stepped out into the heat, Fleck heard the peal of kids' laughter floating up from the grove of evergreen trees behind which he could make out the glimmer of a lake. On the tennis courts behind him, balls thwacked rhythmically back and forth, and from the upper decks of the restaurant, a row of crisp American flags snapped from the railings. An old man in a golf cart putted slowly by. He lifted a gloved hand in greeting. May Hagen was something else, that was for sure. So was Mr. Birch. Flick had come here only to get Josie off his back. Working in a steaming hot kitchen all summer was the last thing he wanted to do, and these people were not his people. Thankfully, the interview was over. His nerves had settled, and so had his stomach. Flick could tell his mother he'd done it and gone on with the summer. Mr. Birch told him he'd think about it, and that Flick should too. But who was he kidding? After how Stan had treated him and how Flick had shown up in Converse sneakers and t-shirt to work at a place like this? Nope. Ned Birch didn't have to think. He was just being polite. Still, as Flick headed for the safety of his car, he glanced over his shoulder once more at the white clapboard building, regal against the rich blue sky. What was it about this place? His stomach flip-flopped one last time. Flick was halfway down the walkway to the parking lot before he realized the truth about the flutter in his stomach. It wasn't nerves. Darn, it was hope. Next chapter, called Ned. The sound of Adam's alarm clock from across the hall rattled him wide awake at 6 a.m. Ned groaned and covered his head with his pillow until Adam finally turned it off. Why is he sending his clock for 6? It's some. Adam's alarm tone was the sound of a fire truck siren that could wake the dead. He'd had it since he was 5 and fully submerged in a fire truck obsession, something he replaced several times since, but he could not part with the clock. At one point, when the clock mysteriously broke, Ned long suspected Ingrid may have had the hand in that, only a particularly bad day. Adam's reaction was vocal and not short-lived. It had sent the family spiraling to various devices to search online for a replacement. Finally, Darcy had found a used one on eBay. Notably, it had not broken since. Ned rolled over to look at his wife, snoring softly beside him. She learned to tune out the alarm just as she had Stan Crenshaw's loud music, which had gone on again until midnight. Ned was half impressed and half annoyed with his wife's ability. He didn't like lying awake alone in his outrage at their neighbors. It was the kind that needed to be shared. It was theirs in solidarity to keep them awake together. As his eyelids flooded with fatigue, his mind wandered to yesterday's interview. He still could not believe it was Flick who walked through his office door. The last time he'd seen Flick Creevy's face was just before the front door had slammed shut in his own. Flick had been standing behind Stan, a mix of surprise and embarrassment clouding his expression. Well, now it was Ned's turn. May Haven had a job that desperately needed filling, and Flick seemed right for the job. Ned could open the door for him or not. What time is it? Ingrid stretched lazily beside him and reached her arm across the growing softness of his middle. Ned had no idea when he had last been on the course or in the lake. The leathery depth of his office chair was the only thing he submerged himself in these days. It's 6:10, he said, planted a kiss on Ingrid's cheek. Board meeting today? Ned tried not to cringe. Yep. You'll be okay, she said. As a realtor in a small town with a tough market, Ingrid understood. We need to help Adam find a job, she reminded him. Adam had quit his last one at the local mech. It was a shame. At first, Adam liked the predictability and precision of bagging groceries, and his parents liked that it forced him to be more social. But a few weeks in, there was an altercation. A customer asked Adam to put the vegetables in a separate bag. When all the groceries were bagged, he noticed that his tomatoes remained on the checkout counter. You forgot the tomatoes, he told Adam. Adam replied, you said to keep the vegetables separate. Yeah, so put the tomatoes in. The customer was growing impatient. Tomatoes are a fruit, Adam informed him. Just put them in, but they're not a vegetable. It ended with the customer raising his voice and Adam covering his ears and running off to the bathroom and a phone call to Ingrid, who was in the middle of an open house two towns away. He's not going back to the market, Ingrid said later over a glass of wine. I guess the tomatoes weren't the only thing that got sacked, Ned replied, as which they'd fallen into hysterics. But the problem remained. Adam was bright and capable, and his parents wanted him to get some work experience. Is there nothing at the club? Ingrid asked. She pressed against Ned. Jane needs help in the front office, he said. Data entry, invoices, that kind of stuff. It wouldn't be much fun. Ingrid brightened. But it's a computer stuff. I bet he'd love that. It was true. Adam loved all things tech-related. It was the people-related stuff he needed to practice with. Let me see what I can do. What about you? Any showings today? Ned gazed at his wife. Ingrid's eyes were so green, so lovely. He wrapped his arms around her, letting his hands trail down across her equally lovely bosom. He was a lucky man, and at the moment, as he held her that way, he hoped he might get even luckier. But Ingrid wanted to talk. She propped herself up, and his hand slipped off her bottle. Actually, I have news. Oh, he reached for her again. Guess what? I'd landed the treehouse. Treehouse? This sounded exciting. But Ned was growing excited about something that did not involve talking. How long had it been? No matter. He needed to listen, really listen. Then maybe they could be excited together. Is that the big cedar house overlooking the lake? He pulled her closer. That's the one. 5,000 unsellable square feet, listed at an ungettable $2.5 million. They signed the listing agreement yesterday. Wow! Why didn't you tell me that last night? He searched her eyes. This was big news. You've been so busy at work, and then the new neighbors. Her voice trailed off. Honey, that's wonderful. Do you think you can sell it? Ingrid rolled over and away from him and stared at the ceiling. I have one new client from Boston. They're wealthy and quirky, and they're looking for a weekend house. Maybe they'll be your buyer. Ingrid smiled. Maybe. You know, I could use some new members, Ned said, rolling playfully on top of her. Ask your buyer if they golf. Very funny. We should celebrate, Ned said. We should. He pressed his lips against her, hoping she'd feel how celebratory he was feeling. To his delight, Ingrid pressed back. Ned groaned with pleasure just as there was a pounding on the bedroom door. We're out of eggs! It was Adam. Adam had eggs for breakfast every morning. There's cereal, Ned shouted in vain, but Ingrid was already scooting out from under him. Sorry, honey, she said, but we both know cereal won't satisfy him. Ned stared at a small crack in the ceiling over their bed. The only thing he knew for sure was that no one would be satisfied that morning. First item on the agenda, new membership. There were two words Ned dreaded most that summer. Dick Delancey was looking right at him, grinning like a Cheshire cat, and for the life of him, Ned could not imagine why. Dick was the board chairman. He had the same dismal numbers on the printout in front of him, the very numbers Ned had been staring at for all June. As president, Dick should be committed to finding solutions and cheering on efforts, but all Ned got from Dick Delancey was pushback and complaints. Fix it, Birch, he had said, saddled up at the bar with a cold beer in front of him. We hired you as our next president to fix it. Now, Ned rose from his chair at the opposite head of the table. Among the eight board members were Neiman Shrive and Bitsy Babcock, the sole female on the board, which Ned had helped facilitate. Neiman and Bitsy were elder members with a history and a love of Mayhaven that rivaled Ned's, but the rest of the board were what the tennis pro had referred to in whispered tones as good old boys. Delancey isn't a team player, she had warned Ned. You're going to be on your own as president and on the hook for whatever comes your way. He started with the good news. Last month, we welcomed 3 new families to Mayhaven. Did you say 3? Dick asked. Ned nodded as Dick scribbled something in an oversized note pad. Full membership for 2 of those families and social membership for the 3rd. So if we're talking the full benefits of full membership fees, it's really more like 2. Dick scribbled some more. I met one of those new families, the Fullertons, Betsy interjected. Nice people. And the mother is an avid golfer, which will be good for us. Betsy was right. Growing Mayhaven's female golf league was a top priority. Not only were the women among some of the best golfers he'd seen, but when more than one member of family played, it secured the chance they'd stay on. There was another reason Ned was also trying to firm up the children's program. Parents invested in their kids, and Mayhaven needed to invest the next generation of tennis players and golfers. How does that offset the building assessment? Scooter Thornton asked. Scooter was a scratch golfer, but just an okay kind of guy. He drank too much in the restaurant and was fond of telling jokes that became crasser with each beer. Of course, Dick loved him. Well, it doesn't offset it much, Ned allowed. He lost the Hendersons to Fox Run. He tried not to let his posture sag with the news. So no offset, more scribbling from Dick. Ned was sorely tempted to ask Dick how he offset Coral's fling bling. Instead, he said, our summer camp program has its highest enrollment in club history, 75 kids. Everyone around the table nodded, and Ned took heart. My hope is that when camp is over, these kids continue with our fall and spring lesson programs. If that happens, we could be in position to host a youth golf tournament. Wouldn't that be something, Betsy said. Maybe your girl will play again. Again. Ned tried not to let his posture sag. Neiman tried snoring. Sounds to me like the courts and course will get noisy. You've been listening to The Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. This is Joanne. Thank you for listening.
Audio Journal, the radio reading service of Central Massachusetts, serving visually and print-impaired listeners since 1987. Audio Journal is a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
Are you a Worcester Regional Transit Authority paratransit rider from Worcester, Auburn, Boylston, Leicester, Northborough, Oxford, Westboro, or West Boylston? Did you know that you no longer have to call customer service to book your trips? You can now take advantage of our new online reservation system and book your trips online at any time. Call customer service at 508-791-9782. Or email paratransit@therta.com to set up your online account to begin scheduling your trips. Please note the online reservation system is an additional option for your convenience. you can still call customer service to book your trips.